you're going to go that way. And please pick up your children at the end of service. Unless you're just wanting to avoid spending money on Christmas presents, you know, then you could leave them here, I suppose. And while they're doing that, believe it or not, after this Sunday, there is only one Sunday left this year. It's hard to believe. The year's just about done. So it is time to fill the calendar up again. I'm going to pass around a calendar. And what we're looking for here is, like we did several months ago, families. It doesn't have to be families. It could be a couple of teenage friends. It could be a couple. It could be an individual. But if you've got three or four of you, it makes it pretty quick work to come in and clean up the church and get it ready for Sunday morning. So this is generally something that needs to be done like Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. So I'm going to pass this around, and we just want to fill up all the weeks this coming year and get that taken care of. So I'll start over here with Terry, and as it makes its way to each section, make sure it gets over on across the room. Well, it's Christmas Sunday. A couple days ago, Teresa's like, "This is Christmas Sunday." And I said, "Yeah, it is." And she goes, "It can't be." I said, "Well, yeah, Christmas is Thursday. So it's here. And it may be the most wonderful time of the year, but for many, it is the most competitive time of the year." And it's something that we learn pretty early on, isn't it? Can you bring up the light so they can see what they're writing here on the calendar? There we go. Anyway, Melissa's shirt back there was just, you know, it was bright. But we learn it pretty early on. Kids start looking at the presents under the tree, and they start counting. How many does my brother have? How many does my sister have? They start picking up and holding them. Who's got the biggest one? Who's got the heaviest one? I was talking to a couple kids out here this morning, and they said, "We're not allowed to touch the presents under the tree. We can't even look at the tags." Like, whoa, pretty tight ship in that house. My mom, there was a couple years she had to assure my sister and I that even though we did not get the same number of presents, they spent the same amount of money on both of us, because they didn't want one of us to feel like we had been short shrifted. And then what happens? The kids go back to school, and it's, "Well, what did you get? Check out what I got." And everybody's wearing their new clothes, and they got their new phones and their new tablets or whatever, and it's all about who's got the biggest and the brightest and the best. And does that really change as we get older? Well, a little bit, but not completely, does it? It never really goes away. It becomes more subtle. It moves to different areas. But for so many of us, Christmas is just a time of year that brings out our competitive nature. We want to do the best and be the best. And sometimes Christmas just feels like something you have to win, or you feel defeated. There's just so many opportunities during the Christmas season to try to prove how good you are, or if your emotional pendulum swings the other direction, to compare yourself to others and find all the ways that you just don't measure up. And so we go through the Christmas season feeling sad and depressed. Even for those of us who don't look at life as a race to win or lose, Christmas is a time where we've got so many things that are competing for our time and our attention. We get one side of the family competing with the other side of the family. Brothers and sisters no longer compete over who got the best presents. Now they compete over who gives the best presents. As adult children, we sometimes compete with our parents or our family and their expectations. "Well, if you don't come here for Christmas, you'll be the only one missing." Anybody ever gotten that kind of guilt trip before? Sometimes husbands and wives compete with each other. "Well, which place will we go to? When? How much time will we spend there? Whose family traditions will we honor?" And then there's the competition of exes and steps and all the other extended family, and then you throw work and school into the mix. Sometimes our competitive nature comes out in how we decorate. Teresa was telling me about one family she worked with, and he said that for the entire month of December, they could not eat at their table because the wife would decorate it for Christmas dinner, and she wanted it perfect the whole month of December. So for the whole month, they didn't eat at the table. We compete with who can lay out the best Christmas spread. We compete with ourselves, our own expectations, our own desires, our gilded memories of Christmas past that never really was quite the way we remember it. But the thing that concerns me with all of this competition and trying to outdo everyone else and just trying to keep up with everything and everyone that demands our time and our attention is that the one we really end up competing with is Jesus. And it's one time of year that we really should be able to focus on him, but it seems like everything just conspires to push him off the throne in our hearts. That brings us to our text this morning in Matthew 2, where we have wise men who want to find Jesus so they can go and worship him. And then we have King Herod who wants to find Jesus so he can go and kill him. You see, for Herod, Jesus was competition. There wasn't room in Herod's life for both Jesus and himself. And here's the bottom line of this morning's message, and I'll put it quite bluntly. Whenever there is competition with Jesus in your heart, something has to die. Herod was correct about that one thing. After telling us the backstory of Joseph and Mary, Matthew covers the birth of Jesus in just one verse, Matthew 1:25. Luke spends a whole chapter. Matthew does it in one verse. And then beginning in chapter 2, he jumps right into the story of the wise men or the magi from the east. And he begins this way. Now, after Jesus was born in Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem. Now, Matthew doesn't mention King Herod to just root this story in time and place. Herod becomes a key figure in the story. He is the antagonist, the bad guy. And given that this was the big opening weekend of Star Wars, we could say he's like the Darth Vader of the story. But he was Herod the First, the founder of the Herodian dynasty. But we have come to know him as Herod the Great. And that's a reputation that Herod worked very hard to earn. He rose to power through a combination of intrigue and military muscle, but mostly it was his prowess at navigating the treacherous waters of Roman politics. There were, in fact, many people who opposed Herod's rise to power, but he managed to win the favor of Caesar, and he secured a senatorial proclamation declaring him king of Judea. Once power was in his grasp, he held on to it with a tenacious grip and wasn't going to let go. He used a carrot when it suited his purposes. For instance, Herod's considered one of the greatest builders in Jewish history, if not the greatest builder. And if you go to Israel today, you can visit many of his architectural exploits from one end of the country to the other. Entire cities like Caesarea by the Sea, which is up north, and its architecture and the mosaics and stuff are still impressive to this day. All the way down to the southern end of Israel, you have the mountaintop fortress of Masada. Let me tell you, it is one of the coolest places on planet Earth you could ever visit. He turned the top of an entire mountain into this giant fortress. It was supposed to be impregnable until the Romans actually built a ramp up the side of it, and they actually were able to bring it down. And you can see the remains of the military encampments and everything to this day. It's pretty cool. Even the Temple Mount, when you go to Jerusalem, you go to the Temple Mount, you are seeing there the work of Herod the Great. And he would build these things all the way across the country. He was the politician that was promising, you know, better bridges and roads. And he built all this stuff. He would curry favor with lavish gifts and these extensive public works projects. So in this sense, he truly was Herod the Great. However, when the carrot didn't work, Herod was not at all shy about wielding a stick. So great was his lust for power that he saw subterfuge and conspiracy everywhere. And armed with a notorious paranoia and an insatiable ambition for power, Herod spied on his own people. He had a secret police throughout the entire country that would report back to him what his people were doing. He dealt with disagreements with brutality. He even had many of his own family members executed just to protect his position. Now we see all of this in his appearance in the Christmas story. On the one hand, we have good Herod, nice Herod. He tries to win the favor of the wise men. But on the other hand, we have bad Herod, who strikes out in a bloody massacre on the most innocent of all victims. You see, for Herod, one who was born king of the Jews was nothing more than a threat to everything that he had spent his entire life building for himself. He had defeated all comers, and there was no way he was going to let some punk kid from Bethlehem take that away from him. I mean, how could he be Herod the Great if there was some other claim to the throne? Now, Herod's pulled into the story quite innocently by these wise men from the east. They're stargazers by trade, part Stephen Hawking and part Nostradamus. They are pagan purveyors of esoteric knowledge, tellers of fortunes, and adept at reading the signs. Now, what it was that they saw, how they knew what it meant, and what it signified, we can only guess. All that we know for sure is they saw something strange in the sky, and they followed it to Jerusalem of Judea. But where to go from there? The star didn't take them all the way to Bethlehem at first, just to Judea. Well, if you're looking for somebody who is born king, who better to ask than royalty, right? So they stop in Jerusalem. They go to the palace of Herod to get some GPS coordinates for this momentous event. Now, these guys were magi. This was a position that was known throughout the ancient world. When these guys showed up at your front door, their reputation precedes them. They know how to read the stars. They have insights into mysterious knowledge. They know secret things. They had a reputation of dealing in the supernatural. And so when these guys show up to Herod asking about somebody born king of the Jews, Herod panics. He freaks out. He's thinking, what do these guys know that I don't? What does this portend for my power? Now, he plays the consummate politician. He smiles for the cameras with a twinkle in his eye. He poses for the front page photo op with the wise men. He speaks exquisitely crafted words. Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word so that I too may come and worship him. Now, Herod has as much intention of worshiping Jesus as Barry Lynn, Richard Dawkins, Bill Maher, and Bill Nye combined. You see, for Herod, Jesus was a threat. He was competition. I mean, star or no star, there would be no other king. Herod was king in Judea. He was the only star who mattered. Herod, however, wasn't really a Jew. He was Idumean by birth. He claimed the title King of the Jews. That's one of the titles he called himself. But these wise men are talking about one born King of the Jews. Well, there can only be one king on the throne. And whenever there are multiple claims competing for the throne, that's not usually a pretty sight. Competitions for the throne are usually bloody and brutal affairs. And so Herod was troubled, but he's not the only one. Did you notice that the text says all of Jerusalem was troubled with him? They all knew that if there was a competition for the throne, it could get ugly. And for the baby boys in Bethlehem, it did. That's how it was that first Christmas. That's how it still is this Christmas. Nothing's really changed. There are too many things competing for the throne. No, not the throne of Judea, but for the throne of your heart and my heart. See, here's the problem. Just like the throne in Judea, there is only room on your throne for one. There's not room on the throne for Jesus and money, for Jesus and college, Jesus and power, Jesus and addiction, Jesus and family, Jesus and popularity, Jesus and pleasure, Jesus and comfort. There's not room for Jesus and anything. And not all of those things are bad. In fact, some of those things are excellent and praiseworthy in their proper place. But they cannot share the throne with Jesus. And what happens with this competition of Christmas is that we're trying to squeeze other things on the throne with Jesus and start putting our own desires and expectations there too, thus kind of choking and crowding Jesus out, or our lives just become so cluttered and crammed with other things that Jesus just kind of gets pushed out of the way. And our hearts become like a bad episode of Hoarders, where they're just so piled high with all sorts of junk that we can't even find the throne in there, let alone Jesus. And we know this is true in principle. We know that our spiritual lives are getting choked out. We know we need to do some house cleaning, but you try to clean one thing up, and it becomes apparent very quickly that something else is on the throne. Have you ever noticed that when you watch those hoarding shows? We watch them just on occasion so we don't feel so bad about our dirty house. But, you know, there they are. They're living in a house that's sometimes piled floor to ceiling with trash and junk and old food, and there's like insects and roaches and rats, and it's nasty, and there's like dog and cat stuff everywhere, and it's horrid, and it's affected their relationships, it's affected their health, and they finally get to this point where they know they need help, and they agree to have somebody come in and help them clean up the house. And so the process begins. But as soon as one of these cleaning experts grabs one item and begins to take it outside to the dumpster, what do? No, you can't take that. And I'm always amazed that in this mountain of junk, they can tell you exactly when they got it, how much they paid for it, and they can tell you what their plan is for it. Well, I'm going to do this with it. I'm going to do that with it. I might need it someday. It's been sitting there for 30 years and they haven't done anything with it. But they've got plans. And it's the same with the clutter in our hearts. No, Lord, I can't get rid of that. That's too important to me. I'm too attached to that. Lord, you can't ask me to clean up that relationship. You don't know how it makes me feel. Oh, Lord, you can't ask me to wait until I'm married. You can't tell me not to move in with that guy or that girl. I mean, that's just what everyone does today. I mean, come on. You can't expect me to give like that, to serve like that. Oh, Lord, you can't expect me to forgive them. You don't know what they did to me. And as soon as Jesus grabs a hold of an individual item in our heart, he becomes a threat. And it shows that something else is on the throne. And that's the real competition of Christmas. Not who has the most presents or who gives the best presents or who has the greatest decorations, but it's who is on the throne of your heart. So what can we learn about the competition of Christmas from this text? What practical help does God's word have for us this morning? Well, the first point I would make is this. God allows the competition for your heart for a reason. I want you to notice in the text the order of events and how they went down. The wise men follow the star west, and it takes them as far as Judea. But the star does not take them all the way to Bethlehem just yet. It gets them into the kind of the correct neighborhood, but they don't know where to go from there. And so they have to stop in Jerusalem, and for the first time, and maybe the only time in recorded history, men stop and ask for directions. That might be what makes them wise men. I don't know. And so they tell Herod what's going on, and Herod says, well, I don't know. Let me call on the chief priests and the teachers of the law. These are the spiritual leaders. These are the religious experts. They talk amongst themselves. They consult their scriptures. They say, well, there's this prophecy in Micah, and it says that Bethlehem of Judea is the correct place. And so they have a place. And then the wise men head out again. And then do you notice what happens in verse 9? And behold, the star they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. Why didn't the star do that to begin with? Why didn't the star just lead them right to the place where the child was? And they could have skipped Jerusalem and King Herod altogether. It seems to me, reading this story, it's almost as if God wanted Herod brought into the story. Why would he do that? We can discuss and debate whether the star was some sort of cosmological phenomenon that God was using, or it was a purely supernatural miracle. But either way, God is behind it, and he seems to be using it in a way that brings in this competition, this threat. Now, we can make some educated guesses as to why. Perhaps to fulfill prophecy. Perhaps he wants to expose Herod for the kind of guy he really is. Maybe he wants to illustrate very early on that you have to make some sort of choice about Jesus. You can worship him, you can oppose him, but you cannot remain neutral about Jesus. But what you need to understand this morning is this. God will do the same thing in your life. He will lead you into situations where you have to make a choice. Will I go right or left? Will I do what's right or what's wrong? Will I do what's wise or what's foolish? And you have to make a choice. You have to decide who's going to be on the throne. And he'll open a door in your life that will allow this stuff to come in. And you will have to decide whether I will love and serve the one or I will love and serve the other. What Jesus will not do, he will not put himself on the throne. Jesus does not usurp power in your heart. You have to put him on the throne. You have to do it in faith. You have to do it out of a commitment of love. So many times, I just wish God would remove all of the competition for him in my heart so that nothing else would compete for my love and devotion to him. And I'll pray, God, just remove the temptation. Take the temptation away. I don't want to struggle with that anymore. Any of you ever prayed that? I know I have. I mean, it would be so much easier to serve him if I didn't have all these desires competing for my loyalty, right? But oh, those pesky desires. Always wanting something else, competing for my time, my love, my attention, my money, and yes, even my worship. But peace in your heart and peace in your life will not come because Jesus simply removes all the competitors. Peace will come because you place Jesus on the throne and let him be Lord over everything else. And that's where you will find peace. So Jesus might just allow a little bit of clutter in your life during Christmas. And in the midst of all that clutter, Jesus, he's going to pick up a piece He's going to say, can I get rid of this? It's just junk. Don't you love me more than this? And you have to choose between the junk and Jesus. You got to choose between Jesus and the addiction, the habit, the foolish choice. Or Jesus will come and he'll pick up another piece and he'll say, well, this is a nice little trinket, but I'm the real treasure. And you have to choose between the trinket or the treasure. What's going to be first? And at that point, something's got to go. There's only room on the throne for one. And either Jesus will be on the throne of your heart, or you'll push him off so something else can be there. And Christmas just has a way, it's one of those times when it has a way of exposing what's really on the throne of your hearts. And it exposes our idols of money, our idols of popularity, our idols of importance and materialism. A second lesson that some of us need to learn is the one the wise men followed, and it's simply this: go another way. Go another way. You see, Herod wanted the wise men to return and give a report so that he too, he said, could go and worship him. But he had no intention of worshiping him. But the Magi had no way of knowing this. They didn't know what Herod was up to. And so God warns them in a dream, and the text says they departed to their own country by another way. So they took I-70 back instead of I-80. Now, why did they do that? I mean, they didn't try to sneak back in through Jerusalem, see if they could avoid Herod's attention. They didn't think, wow, we can outsmart him, we can outwit him. They simply avoided him altogether. There was no need to risk it. Why invite trouble into your life when you can avoid it altogether? Now, I told you there are times when God will bring the competition into your life for a reason, for his reasons. But truth be told, if we look at a lot of the competition in our hearts for Jesus, it is there not because God put it there, it's there because we've invited it there. Instead of avoiding the Herods in our lives, we stop by for a drink or two. We hang out for a while. We chit-chat. We think we're smarter than him. We think we can avoid falling into his trap, but we do it again and again. We think we can play with fire and not get burned. The best counsel I can give some of you this Christmas is simply this: go a different way. Don't do the same thing again and expect different results. It won't work. You go a different way. Don't fall into the same trap. There is a reason why the Bible tells us to flee from temptation. It doesn't say resist temptation, endure temptation. It says get away from it. Listen to this fantastic poem by Portia Nelson. Captures this so well. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost, I am helpless, it isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. Some of us have been there before, haven't we? I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes me a long time to get out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it's there, but I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open, though, and I know where I am. It's my fault. I get out immediately. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. I walk down another street. Go another way. And one final point I would make from the text is this: you're never too far away to come to Jesus. See, it doesn't matter who you are or where you've been, you can come to Jesus. And Matthew really provides a compelling contrast for us here. Even as Israel's ruler seeks to kill Jesus, he is worshipped by these pagans from a far country. Make no mistake, these guys were not good Torah-believing Jews. Now, there are some who speculate that perhaps these magi could trace their lineage all the way back to Daniel, and that's how they understood and knew what this star meant. Maybe. We don't know that. But make no mistake, these guys practiced astrology and fortune-telling. They were involved in practices that were strictly forbidden in the Old Testament. But they were the ones, along with some lowly shepherds, who were there worshiping Jesus. They weren't too far away to come to Jesus. And if the fact that where they were from and the fact that they had spent their lives doing what God said was an abomination wasn't enough to keep them from coming to Jesus, then who you are and where you're from and what you've done isn't too much to keep you from being able to come to Jesus and to worship him. But I also want you to notice who didn't show up in Bethlehem. When the wise men talked to Herod, and Herod didn't know what to answer, who did he consult? He consulted the chief priests and the teachers of the law. He consulted the religious experts. Those guys knew what was happening. They even had the right answer. They opened up their Bibles. They turned to the right text in Micah. They said, Bethlehem is the place. But not one of them showed up. You ever wonder why? They should have been the first in line to welcome and worship the Messiah. They were the experts, but they were nowhere to be found. And just as some of us need to know this morning that you are never too far away, that you can't come to Jesus, others of us need to be reminded this morning that you are never so close to Jesus that you don't need him. But some of us have spent so much of our lives so close to Jesus, we don't recognize our need for him. We just assume he's already on the throne of our heart. That's what the chief priests, that's what the religious leaders thought. I mean, they spent their whole lives in synagogue and studying the Bible. They thought they knew God so well, but when he came in the flesh, they missed him entirely. Just being raised in the church, just being in church every Sunday doesn't mean Jesus is on the throne. Just being raised in a Christian home doesn't mean Jesus is on the throne of your heart. These priests and teachers of the law, they had all the synagogue attendance ribbons. They could answer all of the questions on Bible Jeopardy correctly. But they never showed up to worship Jesus. We don't know why. We can imagine their excuses. Well, I'm too busy. I have a service to conduct. I've got to study. My donkey's in the shop. But for whatever reason, they never made their way to Bethlehem to worship Jesus, even though they knew all about it. Don't just coast through Christmas, counting on your background, your upbringing, a decision that you made years ago. That doesn't necessarily mean that Jesus is on your throne right now, today. Yes, Jesus was born in a manger, and he lived life as one of us. He died on a cross, and he rose from a grave, and he ascended into heaven. But today, right now, this morning, the place he wants to be is on the throne of each and every one of our hearts. That's where he wants to be. And so as we close this morning, my question for you is simply this: who or what is on the throne of your heart? The worship team is going to come and lead us in a song of invitation and worship. And for you, this could be the perfect time to put Jesus back on that throne. It could be the perfect time to take a look at the trinkets or the junk, the trash that's on the throne, and say, you gotta go. There's only room for one. We will have some of our church leaders here at the cross if you need to pray with them. If you just need some time alone with God and you've got some business to take care with Him, our prayer bench is here, and you can come and just pray.